The White Plague by Frank Herbert. Narrated by Scott Brick. Copyright 1982 by Herbert Properties, LLC. This unabridged audiobook is published by arrangement with Herbert Properties, LLC and the Trident Media Group, and was produced in the year 2008 by Tantor Media Incorporated, which holds the copyright thereto. Precede. There's a lust for power in the Irish, as there is in every people, a lusting after the ascendancy where you can tell others how to behave. It has a peculiar shape with the Irish, though. It comes of having lost our ancient ways, the simpler laws, the wrath and the family at the core of society. Romanized governments dismay us. They always resolve themselves into widely separated ascendants and subjects, the latter being more numerous than the former, of course. Sometimes it's done with great subtlety, as it was in America, the slow accumulations of power, law upon law, and all of it manipulated by an elite whose monopoly it is to understand the private language of injustice. Do not blame the ascendants. Such separation requires docile subjects as well. This may be the lot of any government, Marxist Russians included. There's a peculiar human susceptibility you see when you look at the Soviets, them building an almost exact copy of the Tsarist regimes. The same paranoia, the same secret police, the same untouchable military, and the murder squads, the Siberian death camps, the lid of terror on creative imagination, deportation for the ones who cannot be killed off or bought off. It's like some terrible plastic memory sitting there in the dark of our minds, ready on the instant to reshape itself into primitive patterns the moment the heat touches it. I fear for the shape of things which may come from the heat of O'Neill's plague. Truly I fear, for the heat is great. Fintan Craig Doheny. May the hearthstone of hell be his bed rest forever. Old Irish Curse. It was an ordinary grey British Ford, the Spartan economy model with right-hand drive, customary in Ireland. John Roe O'Neill would remember the driver's brown, sweatered right arm resting on the car's windowsill in the cloud-filtered light of that Dublin afternoon. A nightmare capsule of memory, it excluded everything else in the scene. Just the car, and that arm. Several other surviving witnesses commented on a crumpled break in the Ford's left front wing. The break had begun to rust. Speaking from her hospital bed, one witness said, "The brake was a jagged thing, and I was afraid someone would be cut if they brushed against it." Two of those who recalled seeing the car come out of Lower Leeson Street knew the driver casually, but only from his days in postal uniform. He was Francis Blay, a retired postman working part-time as a watchman at a building site in Dunleary. Blay left for work early every Wednesday, giving himself time to run a few errands and then pick up his wife, Tessie. On that one day each week, Tessie spent the morning doing light secretarial for a bedding shop in King Street. It was Tessie's habit to spend the rest of the day with her widowed sister, who lived in a remodeled gatehouse off the Dunleary bypass, just a few minutes out of his way. This was a Wednesday, May 20th. Blay was on his way to pick up Tessie. The Ford's left front door, although appearing undamaged by the accident that had crumpled the wing, still required a twist of wire around the doorpost to keep it closed. The door rattled every time the car hit a bump. "I heard it rattling when it turned onto St. Stephen's Green South," one witness said. "It's God's own mercy I wasn't at the Grafton corner when it happened." Blay turned right off St. Stephen's Green South, which put him on St. Stephen's Green West, hugging the left lane as he headed for Grafton Street. There were better routes for him to make his connection with Tessie, but this was his way.
"He liked to see all the people," Tessie said. "God rest him. That's what he said he missed most when he quit the postal. All the people."
Blay, slight and wrinkled, had that skin-stretched, cadaverous look that is common among certain aged Celts from the south of Ireland. He wore a soiled brown hat almost the exact shade of his patched sweater, and he drove with the patient detachment of someone who came this way often. And if the truth were known, he rather liked being slowed by the heavy traffic. It had been cold and wet through most of spring, and while it was still cloudy, the cloud cover had thinned, and there was a feeling that there might be a break in the weather. Only a few of the pedestrians carried umbrellas. The trees of St. Stephen's Green on Blaze Right were in full leaf. As the Ford inched along in the congested traffic, the man watching for it from a fourth-floor window of the Irish Film Society building nodded once in satisfaction. Right on time. Blaze Ford had been selected because of this Wednesday punctuality. There was also the fact that Blaze did not garage his car where he and Tessie lived in Davitt Road. The Ford was parked outside beside a thick yew hedge, which could be approached from the street along a path shielded by a parked van. There had been a van parked in this covering position the previous night. Neighbors had seen it, but no one had thought to comment at the time.
"There were often vehicles parked in that place," one said. "How are we to know?"
The watcher at the Film Society building had many names, but he had been born Joseph Lee O'Herity. He was a small, solidly fleshy man with a long, thin face and pale, almost translucent skin. Herity wore his blonde hair combed straight back and hanging almost to the collar. His light brown eyes were deeply set, and he had a pugged nose with prominent nostrils from which hair protruded. From his fourth-floor vantage, Herity commanded an overview of the entire setting for the drama he was about to ignite. Directly across from him, the tall trees of the green formed a verdant wall enclosing the flow of vehicles and pedestrians. The Robert Emmet statue stood opposite his window, and to the left of it there was a black-on-white sign to the public toilets. Blaze Ford had stopped with the traffic just to the left of Herity's window. A white tour bus with blue and red stripes down its side loomed over the small Ford. Traffic fumes were thick even at the fourth-floor level. Herity checked Blaze's license number to be certain. Yes, JIA5028. Then there was the crumpled left front wing. The traffic began to inch forward, then stopped once more. Herity glanced left at the Grafton Street corner. He could see the signs of the Toy World shop and the Irish Permanent Society on the ground floor of the red brick building, soon to be taken over by the Ulster Bank. There had been some protest about that, one ragged march with a few signs, but it had died out quickly. The Ulster Bank had powerful friends in the government. Barney and his lot, Herity thought. They think we're ignorant of their scheme to make a peace with the Ulster boys. Again Blaze Ford inched toward the corner, but once more was stopped. There was heavy foot traffic where Grafton took off from St. Stephen's Green. A bald-headed man in a dark blue suit had stopped almost directly beneath Herity's window and was examining the cinema marquee. Two young men pushing bicycles threaded their way past the bald-headed man. The traffic remained stopped. Herity looked down at the top of Blaze's car. So innocent-looking, that car. Herity had been one of the two-man team to emerge from the yew-shrouded van near Blaze's parking spot the previous night. In Herity's hands had been a molded plastic package, which they had attached like a deformed limpet under Blaze's car. At the core of that package lay a tiny radio receiver. The transmitter sat on the windowsill in front of Herity. A small black metal rectangle, it had a thin wire antenna and two recessed toggle switches. One painted yellow, the other red. Yellow armed it, red transmitted. A glance at his wristwatch told Herity that they were already 5 minutes past zero time. Not Blaze's fault. It was the blasted traffic.
"You can set your bloody watch by Blay," the leader of their selection team had said. "The old bastard should be running a tram."
"What are his politics?" Greaves had asked. Who cares about his politics? Herity had countered. He's perfect, and he'll be dying for a grand cause. The street'll be full of people, Greaves had said, and there'll be tourists, sure as hell is full of Brits. We warned them to stop the Ulster boys, Herity had said. Greaves could be an old woman sometimes. They know what to expect when they don't listen to us. It was settled then, and now Blaze Carr was inching once more toward the Grafton Street corner, toward the mass of pedestrians, including the possible tourists. John Roe O'Neill, his wife Mary, and their 5-year-old twins, Kevin and Mairead, could have been classified as tourists, although John expected to be 6 months in Ireland while completing the research called for under his grant from the Pastor Mourne Foundation of New Haven, Connecticut. An overview of Irish genetic research. He thought the title pompous, but it was only a cover. The real research was into the acceptance of the new genetics by a Roman Catholic society, whether such a society had taken a position to cope with the explosive potentials in molecular biology. The project was much on his mind that Wednesday morning, but necessary preparations required his attention. High on his list was the need to transfer funds from America to the Allied Irish Bank. Mary wanted to go shopping for sweaters to keep our darlings warm of an evening. There you go, John teased as they left the Sherborne Hotel, stepping into the rush of tourists and businessmen. Only 4 days in Ireland, and already you sound like a local. And why not? She demanded. And both my grandmothers from Limerick. They laughed, drawing a few curious stares. The children tugged at Mary, anxious to be off shopping. Ireland suited Mary, John thought. She had pale, clear skin and dark blue eyes. Jet black hair. Spanish hair, her family called it, framed her rather round face. A sweet face. Irish skin and Irish features. He bent and kissed her before leaving. It brought a blush to her face, but she was pleased at his show of affection, and she gave him a warm smile as they parted. John walked away briskly, humming to himself, amused when he recognized the tune. Oh, what a beautiful morning! John's Wednesday appointment for transfer of foreign funds was at 2 p.m. at the Allied Irish Bank, Grafton and Chatham Streets. There was a sign just inside the bank's entrance, white letters on black, non-branch customers upstairs. A uniformed guard led him up the stairs to the office of the bank manager, Charles Mulrain, a small nervous man with tow-colored hair and pale blue eyes behind gold-framed glasses. Mulrain had a habit of touching the corners of his mouth with a forefinger, first left side, then right, followed by a quick downward brush of his dark tie. He made a joke about having his office on the first floor. What do you Americans call the second floor? It is confusing until you catch on, John agreed. Well, a quick touching of lips and tie. You understand that we'd normally do this at our main office, but when I called, they assured me it was as a convenience to the customer, Mulrain said. He lifted a folder from his desk, glanced inside it, nodded. Yes, this amount. If you will make yourself comfortable here, I'll just get the proper forms and be right back. Mulrain left, giving John a tight smile at the door. John went to the window and pulled back a heavy lace curtain to look down on Grafton Street. The sidewalks were thick with people all the way up to the arched gateway into St. Stephen's Green, 2 short blocks up Grafton. The motor traffic was 2 abreast, filling the street and crawling along toward him. There was a workman cleaning the parapet on the roof of the shopping center diagonally across the street, a white-coated figure with a long-handled brush. He stood outlined against a row of 5 chimney pots. Glancing at the closed door of the manager's office, John wondered how long Mulrain would be. Everything was so damn formal here. John looked at his watch. Mary would arrive with the children in a few minutes. They planned to have tea. Then John would walk down Grafton to Trinity College and begin work at the college library, the real start of his research project. Much later, John would look back on those few minutes at the bank manager's first-floor window and think how another sequence of events had been set in motion without his knowledge. An inescapable thing, like a movie film, where one frame followed another without ever the chance to deviate. It all centered around Francis Blay's old car and a small VHF transmitter in the hands of a determined man watching from an open window that looked down on that corner where Grafton met St. Stephen's Green. Blay, patient as always, eased along at the traffic's pace. Harrity, in his window vantage point, toggled the arming switch of his transmitter, making sure the antenna wire dangled out over the sill. As he neared the Grafton corner, the crush of pedestrians forced Blay to stop, and he missed the turn of the traffic light. He heard the tour bus gain clear of traffic off to his right, trundling off in a rumble of its heavy diesel. Barricades were being erected on the building to his left, and a big white-on-red sign had been raised over the rough construction. This building to be remodeled by G. Tottenham Sons Limited. Blay looked to his right and noted the tall blue-and-white Prestige cafeteria sign, feeling a small pang of hunger. The pedestrian isthmus beside him was jammed with people waiting to cross over to St. Stephen's Green, and others struggling to make a way through the cars stopped on Grafton and blocking Blay's path. The crush of pedestrians was particularly heavy around Blay's car, people passing both front and back. A woman in a brown tweed coat, a white parcel clutched under her right elbow, and each hand grasping a hand off a small child, hesitated at the right front corner of Blay's car while she sought an opening through the press of people. John Rowe O'Neill, standing at the bank manager's window, recognized Mary. He saw her first because of her familiar tweed coat and the way she carried her head, that sleek cap of jet hair. He smiled. The twins were screened from him by the hurrying adults, but he knew from Mary's stance that she held the children's hands. A brief break in the throng allowed John a glimpse of the top of Kevin's head and the old Ford with the driver's brown-sweatered elbow protruding. "Where is that damn bank manager?" John wondered. "She'll be here any minute." He dropped the heavy lace curtain and looked once more at his wristwatch. Harrity, at the open window above and behind Blay, nodded once more to himself. He stepped back away from the window and toggled the second switch on his transmitter. Blay's car exploded, ripped apart from the bottom. The bomb, exploding almost under Blay's feet, drove him upward with a large piece of the car's roof, his body crushed, dismembered, and scattered. The large section of roof sailed upward in a slow arc to come crashing onto the Irish Permanent Society building, demolishing chimney pots and slates. It was not a large bomb, as such things went, but it had been expertly placed. The old car was transformed into jagged bits of metal and glass, an orange ball of fire peppered with deadly shrapnel. A section of the car's bonnet decapitated Mary O'Neill. The twins became part of a bloody puddle blown against the iron fencing across the street at St. Stephen's Green. Their bodies were more easily identified later, because they were the only children of that age in the throng. Harrity did not pause to glance out at his work. The sound told it all. He tucked the transmitter into a small and worn military green pack, stuffed an old yellow sweater onto it, strapped the cover, and slung the pack over his shoulder. He left the building by the back way, elated and satisfied. Barney and his group would get this message. John O'Neill had looked up from his wristwatch just in time to see the orange blast envelop Mary. He was saved from the window's shattered glass by the heavy curtains, which deflected all but one of the shards away from him. One small section of glass creased his scalp. The shock wave staggered him, driving him backward against a desk. He fell sideways, momentarily unconscious, but getting quickly to his knees as the bank manager rushed into the room, shouting, "Good God! What was that?" John stumbled to his feet, rejecting the question and the answer that rumbled through his head like an aftershock of the blast. He brushed past the bank manager and out the door. His mind remained in shock, but his body found its way down the stairs. He shouldered a woman aside at the foot of the stairs and lurched out onto the street, where he allowed himself to be carried along by the crowd rushing toward the area of the blast. There was a smell of burnt iron in the air, and the sound of cries and screams. Within only a few seconds, John was part of a crush being held back by police and uninjured civilians pressed into service to keep the area around the explosion clear. John elbowed and clawed his way forward.
"My wife!" he shouted. "I saw her. She was there. My wife and our children!"
A policeman pinned his arms and swung him around, blocking John's view of the tangled fabric and bloody flesh strewn across the street. The groans of the injured, the cries for help, and the shouts of horror drove John into insensate rage.
"Mary needs me,"
he struggled against the policeman.
"Mary! She was right in front of—"
"The ambulances are coming, sir. There's help at hand. You must be still. You cannot go through now."
A woman off to John's left said,
"Let me through. I'm a nurse."
This, more than anything else, stopped John's struggles against the policeman. People were helping. There was a nurse.
"It'll be cleared up in a bit, sir," the policeman said.
His voice was maddeningly calm.
"That's a bad cut on your head. I'll just help you across to where the ambulances are coming."
John allowed himself to be led through a lane in the crowd, seeing the curious stares, hearing the voices on his right oohing, and the calling upon God to look over there, the odd voices telling John about things he did not want to see. He knew, though, and there were glimpses past the policeman who helped him to a cleared place against a building across from the green.
"There now, sir," the policeman said. "You'll be taken care of here."
Then, to someone else,
"I think he was hit by a flying bit. The bleeding seems to have stopped."
John stood with his back against a scarred brick wall from which the dust of the explosion still sifted. There was broken glass underfoot. Through an opening in the crowd to his right, he could see part of the bloody mess at the corner, the people moving and bending over broken flesh. He thought he recognized Mary's coat behind a kneeling priest. Somewhere within him there existed an understanding of that scene. His mind remained frozen, though frigidly locked into limited thought. If he allowed himself to think freely, then events would flow. Time would continue. A time without Mary and the children. It was as though a tiny jewel of awareness held itself intact within him, understanding, knowing. But nothing else could be allowed to move. A hand touched his arm. It was electric. A scream erupted from him, agonized, echoing down the street, bringing people whirling around to stare at him. A photographer's flash temporarily blinded him, shutting off the scream, but he could still hear it within his head. It was more than a primal scream. This came from deeper, from some place he had not suspected and against which he had no protection. Two white-coated ambulance attendants grabbed him. He felt his coat pulled down, shirt ripped. There came the prick of a needle in his arm. They hustled him into an ambulance as an enveloping drowsiness overwhelmed his mind, sweeping away his memory. For a long time afterward, memory would not reproduce those shocked minutes. He could recall the small car, the brown sweatered elbow on the window sill, but nothing afterward. He knew he had seen what he had seen. The explosion, the death. Intellectual awareness argued the facts. I was standing at that window. I must have seen the blast. But the particulars lay behind a screen that he could not penetrate. It lay frozen within him, demanding action lest the frozen thing thaw and obliterate him.
Despair and grief suit the Celtic mind more than do joy and victory. Every Celtic joy has its mixture of grief. Every victory leads to despair.
Fintan Craig Doheny. Stephen Browder read about the Grafton Street bombing while sitting on the grass of the quad at the medical school of University College, Cork. As a third-year student, Browder had learned enough about school routine to provide himself with a long lunch hour and a chance to crack the books and catch his breath between classes. He had chosen this luncheon spot, however, because some of the student nurses shared it, and Kathleen O'Gara frequently was among that lunching troop. It was a warm day, and this had brought many others into the quad, all of them preferring the green to the Gothic stone monstrosity of the school, which often seemed to partake more of the old jail that once had occupied this spot than of a modern medical facility. The Cork Examiner in his hands was only a prop, but he had been caught by the picture of a screaming man. American tourist loses family, and he read the story, shaking his head now and then at the horror of it. Browder's attentions to Kathleen O'Gara had not gone without notice among the student nurses. They teased her about it now.
"There he is, Katie. I'll loan you a handkerchief to drop in front of him."
Kate blushed, but could not keep herself from looking across the green at Browder. He was a skinny, gawkish young man with sandy hair and widely set blue eyes. His whole bearing gave promise of his becoming one of those stoop-shouldered general practitioners who inspire so much faith among their patients by their towering benignity. There was a persistent thoughtfulness about him that she liked. The shyness was sure to become learned diffidence and a down-the-nose austerity that would go well with his finely chiseled features. Browder looked up from his newspaper and met Kate's eyes. He looked away quickly. He had been trying for 2 weeks to work up his courage, seeking a way to ask her to go out with him. He berated himself now for not smiling back at her. He could not really define why she attracted him. She had a youthful figure, a bit on the sturdy side, but comely. Her skin carried those fine surface veins that gave a rosy hue to the complexion. Her hair now, that was a shining red-brown, part of the Viking legacy, and her dark brown eyes were set rather deeply under a wide brow. He knew she was recognized as a good worker, bright and cheerful, and he had heard another nursing student say about her, "She's no beauty, but good enough to get a husband." "She is beautiful in her own way," he thought. Again he glanced at her, and their eyes met. She smiled, and he forced himself to smile before breaking the contact. His heart was beating strongly, and he bent over the newspaper for distraction. The picture of the screaming man seemed to stare out at him, chilling him. The poor fellow's entire family gone in that blast. The wife and 2 children. For a moment Browder had a fantasy picture of himself married to Kate O'Gara. Children, of course. And them gone like this. All of them, without any warning. Everything that had gone into Stephen Browder's choice of profession felt outraged by that bombing. Was anything worth it? Even the reuniting of all Ireland, which he solemnly prayed for on holy days, could that justify this act? A splinter group of the IRA, the Provos, was claiming credit according to the Examiner's story. Browder had friends in the IRA. One of his fellow students made explosives for them. The sympathies of the University College student body were not hard to discover. They wanted the Brits out. Damn the Brits. Browder felt torn by his Republican sympathies and his shock at what had been done to those people in Dublin. 31 dead, 76 maimed and injured, and all because some people in the Dale were reportedly wavering, talking about an accommodation. There could be no accommodation with the Brits. Never. But would the bombs ever solve anything? A shadow fell on his newspaper. Browder looked up to see Kate O'Gara standing there looking down at him. Hastily he scrambled to his feet, spilling an anatomy textbook from his lap, losing part of his newspaper. He looked down at her, suddenly conscious that he was more than a head taller. "You're Stephen Browder, aren't you?" she asked. "Yes. Yes, I am." She had a lovely, soft voice, he thought. and he had an abrupt insight into what a powerful asset such a voice could be to a nurse. It was a calming voice. It gave him courage.
"And you're Kate O'Gara," he managed.
She nodded.
"I saw you reading about that bombing. The one in Dublin. What a terrible thing."
"'Tis that," he agreed. Then before he lost courage, "Must you go back to classes now?"
"I've only these few minutes."
"And what time do you finish?" He knew he was blushing as he asked. She lowered her gaze.
What long lashes she has, he thought.
They lay like feathers on her cheeks.
"I would like to see you," he said.
And that was God's own truth. He couldn't take his eyes off her.
"I'm expected home at 5:30, she said,
looking up at him.
"We could have a tea, perhaps, on the way."
"Shall we meet here after classes, then?" he asked.
"Yes."
She smiled and hurried off to join her friends. One of the other student nurses, having watched the two of them, whispered to a companion,
"God, I'm glad that's finally done."
Holy Ireland was just a name, a myth, a dream that had no connection with any reality. It was our tradition, a part of our reputation, at one with the myth that we have only the honour gained from glorious battle. Father Michael Flannery. John Roe O'Neill awakened to see a priest standing beside him and a doctor standing at the foot of his bed. He could feel the bed under him and smelled antiseptics. This would be a hospital, then. The doctor was a tall, older man with gray at the temples. He wore a green street jacket, stethoscope in the pocket.
"Why am I here?" John wondered.
It was a hospital ward, he saw. Other beds with figures in them. It was a blankly impersonal room, a place designed with malice to negate the personality of the occupant, as though someone had worked consciously and with a great deal of hate to create a place that would reflect no human warmth. If this room uttered any statement, it was, "You won't live long here." John tried to swallow. His throat hurt. He had been dreaming about Mary. She had been swimming away from him in the dream, a great blue expanse of water all around, and no sound in her movements, even when he saw the water splashing.
"I'm going for the children," she said.
He heard that, but still no sound of swimming. His dream self had thought, "Of course. She must go for the children. Kevin and Mairead will need her." In the dream he could sense Mary's mind as though it were his own. Her mind conveyed an oddly crystalline quality like the aftermath of fever.
"I can't feel my body," she said. "Poor John. I love you."
Then he was awake, his eyes burning, and the priest and the doctor there. It was a green place with a carbolic smell that separated it from the memories of American hospitals. There were bonneted sisters bustling about, and when one saw him awake, she hurried away. The shade was up on a single tall window to the left of the doctor. Darkness outside. It was night then. Light came from unshaded bulbs dangling on long wires from a high ceiling. The doctor was examining a clipboard that was attached by a string and hook to the foot of the bed.
"He's awake," the priest said.
The doctor let the clipboard fall back onto its string and looked down the length of the bed at John.
"Mr. O'Neill, you'll be all right, fit as a fiddle by morning."
He turned and walked away. The priest leaned toward John.
"Are you Catholic, sir?"
"Catholic?" It seemed an insane question.
I'm St. Rose's Parish."
Now why should he tell the priest the name of his parish? The priest put a gentling hand on John's shoulder.
"There, there. I quite understand."
John closed his eyes. He heard a scraping of a chair on the floor, and when he opened his eyes, saw that the priest had sat down, bringing his face close to John's.
"I'm Father Devon," the priest said. "We know who you are, Mr. O'Neill, from your things. Would you be related to the O'Neills of Killeany, by the way?"
"What?"
John tried to raise himself, but his head started spinning.
I don't know."
"It would be good to have family around you at such a time. Your wife's body has been identified. Her purse. I'll not go into the particulars."
"What particulars?"
John wondered. He recalled a bloody mound of tweed, but could not place it in time or space.
"It's very bad news to be given you, Mr. O'Neill,"
Father Devon said.
"Our children," John gasped, grasping at hope. "The twins were with her."
"Ah," Father Devon said.
"Well, now, as to that, I don't know. It's been quite a few hours and all the nasty work done, but were the Waynes with her when
she was holding their hands?
Then I would not hold out much hope. What a terrible thing. Shall we pray for the souls of your loved ones?"
"Pray?" John turned his head away, choking. He heard the chair scrape, footsteps approaching. A woman's voice said, "Father," then something that John could not make out. The priest responded in a low, unintelligible murmur. Then the woman's voice, clearly.
"Mother of Mercy! His wife and the two little ones, both! Oh, the poor man!"
John turned back in time to see a nursing sister departing, her back stiff. The priest was standing beside him.
"Were your wife and children Catholic as well?"
Father Devon asked. John shook his head. He felt feverish and dizzy.
"Why these questions? Mixed marriage, eh?"
Father Devon, having jumped to a wrong conclusion, sounded accusatory.
"Well, my heart goes out to you all the same. The remains have been taken to the morgue. We can decide in the morning what's to be done with the remains."
"Remains?" John thought. "He's talking about Mary and the twins." The doctor returned and moved down the side of the bed opposite the priest. John turned toward the doctor and saw that the nursing sister had reappeared there beside him as though by magic. She wore a white apron over a green dress, and her hair was contained by a tightly hooded cap. Her face was thin and commanding. She held a hypodermic in her right hand.
"Something to help you sleep," the doctor said.
Father Devon spoke.
"The Garda will be in to talk to you in the morning. Send for me when they've gone."
"We'll have the lights down now," the doctor said.
"And high time it is."
The nursing sister had a demanding voice with considerable tartness in it, a protective voice. He held to that thought as sleep enveloped him. Morning was the sound of rattling bedpans on a cart. John awoke to see a uniformed police officer standing where the priest had been.
"They said you'd be awakening soon," the officer said.
He had a mellow tenor, a square face with prominent veins. His hat was held stiffly under his left arm. He pulled a small notebook from a side pocket and prepared to write.
"I'll not trouble you over much, Mr. O'Neill. But I'm sure you can appreciate there are things we must do."
"What do you want?"
John's voice remained a croak. His head still felt fuzzy.
"Would you be telling me what you were doing in the Republic of Ireland, sir?"
John stared up at the officer.
"Doing?"
The question wandered aimlessly in his awareness for a time. His mind felt thick and dogged. He had to force a response.
"I was Foundation Grant, doing research."
"On the nature of this research?"
Genetics.
The officer wrote in his notebook. Then,
"And is that your occupation? Researcher?"
I teach molecular biology, biochemistry, and,"
he took a deep, trembling breath,
"School of Pharmacy as well."
"And that would be in this Highland Park in the state of Minnesota?"
We've seen your papers, you understand.
Nearby.
You've family here in the Republic of Ireland?
We're going to look.
I see.
The officer wrote this in his pad. John labored against a tightness in his chest. He found his voice presently.
Who did it?
Sir?
The bomb.
The officer's face grew stony.
They're saying it was the provost taking the credit.
A chill shot through John. The hard pillow under his neck felt damp and cold. Credit. The murderers were claiming credit? Later, John would look back on that moment as the beginning of the rage that took over his entire life. That was the moment when he promised, "You will pay." Oh, how you will pay. And there was no doubt in his mind at all how he would set about making them pay.
Do you realize that this one man is changing the political map of the world?
General Lucius Gorham, U.S. Presidential Foreign Affairs Advisor, speaking to the Secretary of Defense. The warning letters began arriving during the week before the first anniversary of the Grafton Street bombing. The first one was timed to reach Ireland too late for counteraction. Others went to world leaders, where they were treated as crank letters or were bucked along to specialists. The letters were numerous at first, to radio and television news departments, to newspapers, to prime ministers and presidents and church leaders. It was determined later that one of the first letters was delivered to a newspaper editor on Dublin's O'Connell Street. The editor, Alex Coleman, was a dark and vital man who covered his drive with a generally mild manner, even when he was being most forceful. He was considered an oddity among his peers because of his strong temperance beliefs, but none doubted his penetrating alertness to a good story. Coleman read the letter several times, glancing up occasionally to look out his third-floor window onto the street, where Dublin's morning traffic already had begun to congeal into its usual frustrating crawl. Crank letter? The thing didn't have that feeling about it. The warnings and threats made his skin crawl. Was this possible? The words had an educated air about them. Sophisticated. The thing was typed on bond paper. He rubbed the paper between his fingers. Expensive stuff. Oney O'Moore, Coleman's personal secretary, had clipped a note to the letter. "I hope this is a crank. Should we call the Garda?" So it had worked its disturbance on Oney. Once more Coleman read through the letter, seeking some reason to disregard it. Presently he put the letter flat in front of him and keyed the intercom to Oney. "Sir?" Oney's voice always had a military abruptness. "Check out the Achill Island angle, will you, Oney? Don't stir up any hornets. Just find out if there's anything unusual afoot." "Right away." Coleman returned his attention to the letter. It was so damn direct, so clear and straightforward. A mind of power and, yes, terrifying purpose lay behind it. There was the usual warning to publish or else. But then, "I am going to wreak an appropriate revenge upon all of Ireland, Great Britain, and Libya." The expressed justification rang a bell in Coleman's memory. "You have wronged me by killing my loved ones. By my hand alone you are being called to account. You murdered my Mary and our children, Kevin and Mairead. I have sworn a treble vow on their memories. I will be avenged in kind." Coleman again keyed the intercom and asked Oney to check on those names.
"And while you're at it, call the college hospital and see if you can get me through to Finn Doheny."
"That would be Fintan Craig Doheny, sir."
"Right."
Once more Coleman read the letter. He was interrupted by the telephone and intercom simultaneously. Oney's voice said, "Dr. Doheny on the line, sir." Coleman picked up the phone.
"Finn,
What's so all-fired important, Alex? O'Neill Moore sounds like he's been scalded. I've a threatening letter, Finn. And there's some technical stuff in it. Mind listening a minute? Get on with it.
Doheny's voice had an echo quality, suggesting a speakerphone.
Is someone else with you? Coleman asked.
No.
What's got the wind up?
Coleman sighed and returned his attention to the letter, extracting the technical references for Doheny.
It's hard to say from just a letter, Doheny said, but I find no fault with his references to the recombinant DNA process. You know, Alex, it is possible that way to make new diseases. But this, the threat, could be real. I'd give that a qualified yes.
Then I shouldn't disregard this thing.
I'd be calling the Garda.
Is there anything else I should be doing?
Well, I'll give that a think and be back to you.
One thing, Finn. Not a word on this until I've had a go at it.
Ah, you scrambling newspaper men.
But there was a hint of laughter in Doheny's voice that Coleman found reassuring. A qualified yes. Doheny wasn't too worried then. It was still a good story, though, Coleman thought as he replaced the telephone in its cradle. A bomb victim's vengeance. Medical expert says the thing's possible. Oney's voice came over the intercom.
Sir, that bomb at Grafton and St. Stephen's Green, you remember that?
That bloody thing.
Sir, three of the victims had the names in this letter. There was a Mary O'Neill killed with her twin children, Kevin and Mairead.
From America, yes, I remember.
The husband was at the window of a bank down the street and saw it all happen. Name of...
Oney paused. Then,
Dr. John Roe O'Neill.
Medical?
No, a professor of some sort. He was here on one of those foundation grant things they're so fond of. Studying the state of genetics or some...
Yes, that's what our story says. Genetics research.
Genetics? Coleman mused.
According to our story at the time, sir, this O'Neill had something to do with physical chemistry. A biophysicist, and he taught at some school of pharmacy in the States. Says here, he also owned a pharmacy there.
Coleman suddenly shuddered. He felt that something evil had crawled beneath the surface of his land, a thing more venomous than any snake the sainted Patrick had banned. That IRA bomb could come to be known as the most awful mistake in human history.
"Any luck getting through to Ackle?" Coleman asked.
"The lines are jammed, sir. Should we dispatch an aircraft?"
"Not yet.
Get on to the Garda. If the Ackle phones are jammed, they may know something. Did you copy this letter?"
2 copies, sir.
They'll want the original. If they don't have one of their own already.
I thought of that. I just don't like tipping our hand. We may have a head start on this.
Well, we'll just have to chance it.
He glanced down at the letter on his desk.
I don't suppose there's any chance of getting fingerprints off this anyway.
Are we going ahead with the story, sir?
Only I'm almost afraid not to publish it.
There's something about it.
And singling out Ackle this way. A demonstration, he says.
Sir, you've thought of the panic we might...
Just get me the Garda, Oney.
Right away, sir.
Coleman picked up his phone and called his wife at home, making it brief and imperative.
There's going to be trouble over a story we're about to publish, he explained. I want you to take the boys and go to your brother's in Madrid.
When she started to protest, he cut her off.
This is going to be bad, I think. If you're here, I'm vulnerable. Don't waste any time. Just leave. Call me from Madrid and I'll explain.
He replaced the phone in its cradle, feeling somewhat foolish but relieved.
Panic.
If this thing proved to be true, there would be worse than panic. He stared at the letter, focusing on the signature. The madman. Coleman shook his head slowly, recalling the tale of the Irish coffin ship survivor who, making a cross of shovels over his wife's grave at Grosse Isle, Quebec, had vowed, "By the cross, Mary, I swear to avenge your death. O'Neill's wife had been named Mary. And now, if this was O'Neill, he called himself simply the madman.
They are a torture, my memories. A lovely torture.
Joseph Herity. The pattern of change built itself slowly in John Roe O'Neill. It set him trembling unexpectedly at odd moments, his heart pounding, sweat breaking out all over his body. At such times he thought of the old beliefs in possession. He was like that, another personality taking over his flesh and nerves. Much later he came to a personal accommodation with this other, even a sense of familiarity and identity. He thought of it then as partly his own making, partly a thing rising out of primal darkness, a deliberate creation for the task of revenge. Certainly his old self had not been up to such a deed. The kindly teacher of the young could not have contemplated such a plan for an instant. The other had to come into being first. As the change progressed, he came to think of himself as Nemesis revived. This nemesis came out of Ireland's bloody past, out of the betrayals and murders, and even carried with it a retaliation against the Celtic extermination of the first people, the Danans, who had been in Ireland before the waves of invaders from Britain and the continent. He saw himself then as a spokesman for all of the accumulated wrongs suffered in Ireland. It was Nemesis blaring, "Enough! Let it end!" But the other asked, "Why should Ireland shoulder it all alone?" The terrorists who had killed Mary and the twins had been trained and armed in Libya. And there was England's filthy hand in the whole mess. 800 years of cynical oppression. Ireland, the guilty conscience of the English ruling class. As this change became fixed in its purpose, John saw an astonishing alteration of his appearance. The old, almost plump self went stringing down to a slender, nervous man who avoided old friends, refused to answer the telephone, and ignored appointments. People made allowances at first. The awful shock of such a tragedy. The foundation that had sent him to Ireland gave him an unrequested extension on the project, with a polite letter asking if he wanted to turn it over to another researcher. The school extended his leave of absence. Max Dunn, who managed the family pharmacy, took over more of the business decisions and told John not to concern himself with anything except getting his life back in order. John merely noted these things in passing. The change within him had become an obsession. Then he looked at himself in the bathroom mirror one Saturday morning and knew he would have to take action. Mary and the twins had been dead and buried 4 months. The other was strong in him now. A new face, a new personality. He stood in the upstairs bathroom of the home he and Mary had bought when they had first learned of her pregnancy. The sounds of the old college town drifted up to him through the open window. There was a feeling of fall in the air, but the forecast was for another 2 weeks of warmer-than-normal weather. John could hear Mr. Neary down the street running his power mower. A bicycle bell went jingling past. Children shouted on their way to the park. It was September already. He knew that. And he remembered how Kevin and Mairead had shouted at play in the yard. Neary shut down his mower. Mrs. Neary had been one of the most persistent callers. "You're wasting away to skin and bones, you poor man." But Mrs. Neary had a younger sister, unmarried and getting anxious. There had been a matchmaker's look in Mrs. Neary's plump face. John leaned close to the mirror and looked at himself carefully. The changes. Not quite a stranger, but strange. They won't have any photographs of this face, he thought, but they would make drawings and spread them far and wide. At that moment, the thought still in his mind, he knew he was going to do this thing, knew he was capable of it, and would certainly do it.
That scream at St. Stephen's Green had set something in motion, like the slow beginning of an avalanche. "Let it come, then," he thought. That morning he put his house on the market, and, because properties near the college were much in demand, he had it sold 2 weeks later to a nice young assistant professor, as the real estate woman called him. All of these people were like dream faces to John. His thoughts had gone questing ahead to the thing that needed doing. The nice young assistant professor had wanted to know when Dr. O'Neill would be returning to his post at the school. "We heard about your tragedy, of course, and we understand why you're selling. All of the memories." "He doesn't understand at all," John thought. But the transaction put a clear $188,000 in John's pocket. The real estate woman had tried to talk to John about his tax obligations and had worked to sell him a much better investment a bit farther out, but on land sure to increase in value dramatically over the next 10 years. He had lied to her, saying his accountants already had the problem in hand. The contents of the house had brought an astonishing $62,000, but then Mary's father had left her some valuable old books and 2 fine paintings. Her family's furniture had included several antiques, a thing John had never even thought about before. Furniture had always been only something to fill the spaces in a house. The college fund they had set aside for the twins yielded another $33,000. There was the McCarthy annuity from John's mother, against which the bank loaned him $56,000. Their small portfolio of stocks brought $28,900. The bank accounts over which Mary had worked so hard brought $31,452. Almost $30,000 remained in the grant for the Ireland project, money he had not transferred to the Allied Irish Bank, keeping it in a high-interest brokerage fund that the foundation had approved. His salary, reduced by the sabbatical's requirements, produced close to $16,000 more. Friends and associates had seen only the surface of this activity, taking it as a good sign John's finally getting back to normal. The most delicate parts of the transition involved dealing with the Internal Revenue Service and the sale of the pharmacy that had been in his mother's family now for 2 generations. Max Dunn said he understood that John might not want to publicize the sale, and besides, I'd want to keep the McCarthy name over the door. From family sources, Dunn produced a $78,000 down payment and agreed to a 1-year deferral on starting payments on the balance, none of which John ever intended to collect. The $78,000 was what he wanted, cash. The IRS he put off with a token payment of $5,000 and a letter from his accountants explaining that due to the tragedy and attendant problems, time was required to settle the taxpayers' affairs. The IRS, mindful of the sympathy for John and wary of adverse publicity, granted a 6-month deferral. On the day he left Highland Park in his station wagon, John had almost $500,000 tucked away in the back in the fireproof box that once had held his will and property deeds. The rest of the wagon was crammed full of the carefully packed elements of his personal laboratory, including his computer. 2 suitcases of clothing had to be secured under the safety belt beside him on the front seat. Friends accepted the story that he was going to look for some place farther out, a place without these memories. Late that evening he ate supper almost 400 miles away from the place he no longer called home, sitting in a roadside cafe that smelled of rancid grease. He chose a booth that gave him a view of the car parked outside, noting the gray film of dust that gave it a run-down look. That was good. The grill still showed a shallow dent Mary had put there while trying to maneuver out of a supermarket parking lot. John left without finishing the meal, and could not even remember what he had ordered. Later he found a motel with an alcove parking place beside his room. He transferred the fireproof box to a place under the bed, put his father's old .38 Colt under the pillow, and lay down fully clothed, not expecting to sleep. He could feel the presence of that box under the bed. The money represented energy for the thing he knew he had to do. Every sound outside brought him to alertness. Headlights sweeping across the window draperies set his heart pounding. Activity outside subsided as the night wore on, and he told himself he would nap a bit. Someone starting a car awakened him, and he opened his eyes to gray morning light around the edges of the draperies. And he was hungry. "Those two Waynes dead will not win us friends. Could you not have waited just a bit?"
Kevin O'Donnell. "Me standing back out of the window. I could not see them down there."
Joseph Herity.
In the months after their first meeting in the quad, Stephen Browder and Kate O'Gara moved slowly from tentative acquaintance to what her mother called an understanding.
"She's walking out with this young man who'll be a doctor," Kate's mother told her next-door neighbor.
"Ah, that's a fine catch," the neighbor said.
"Well, my Katie's no slouch around, and her almost a nurse."
"It'll be a fine thing. Two medical people in the family," the neighbor agreed.
On a Friday late in October, Stephen borrowed a fellow student's car, having arranged to take Kate to the Blackwater hilltop south of Cork for supper and the dancing afterward. He had been saving for a month to afford this outing, and it was a daring thing to do. The BH, as it was known in Cork, had the reputation of a fast roadhouse, but their Guinness was the best, and their chef brought regular customers from as far away as Dublin. The car was a 6-year-old Citroen, whose offside showed a long series of scratches from scraping a bridge abutment. It had once been silver grey, but the student owner had repainted it a garish fluorescent green. Kate, suppressing serious guilt feelings, told her mother they were going with other students to the harvest fair at Mallow, and that they planned to stay for the fireworks, the late supper, and the music. Her mother, remembering similar outings in her own youth, admonished,
"Now, Katie, don't let your young man make any advances."
"Stephen is serious, Mama."
"Well, so am I."
"We'll be back by midnight, or soon after, Mama."
"That's very late, Katie. What will the neighbours think?"
"I'll be giving them no cause to think anything, Mama."
"You'll be with the others all the time?"
"All the time,"
Kate lied. Once she was in the car with Stephen, the guilt feelings made Kate angry, and there was only one target. The sky was still luminous with the long twilight, and there was a large moon low on the horizon, almost full, heavy with orange and the promise of a bright night. She stared out at the moon, intensely conscious of Stephen beside her and the privacy of the car, which purred along accompanied by a faint smell of burning oil. Stephen was not an expert driver, and he compensated by holding down his speed. Several cars roared around them and cut in sharply, forcing him to swerve.
"Why are we going so slow?" Kate asked.
"There's plenty of time," Stephen said.
His calm, reasonable tone maddened her.
"We shouldn't be doing this, Stephen, and you know it."
He took his eyes off the road to stare at her, and the car followed his gaze, rolling off the left edge of the paving onto gravel. Stephen jerked the wheel, and they swerved back onto the paving.
"But you told me you wanted," he began. "No matter what I said, it's wrong."
"Katie, what's the matter with—"
"I lied to Mama."
Two tears rolled down her cheeks.
"She'll be waiting there, worried. It's not been easy for her, Stephen, since my father died."
Stephen pulled into a lay-by and stopped the car. He turned and faced her.
"Katie, you know how I feel about you."
He reached for her hand, but she jerked it away.
"I'll not have you sad," he said.
"Then let's really go to the fair."
She looked at him, her eyes glistening.
"That way it'll not really have been a lie."
"If that's what you want, Katie."
"Oh, it is. It is."
"Then that's what we'll be doing."
"It'll save your money too, Stephen," she said, reaching for his hand. "You can buy that new stethoscope you've been wanting."
Stephen kissed her fingers, realizing that he had been maneuvered, and this likely was a pattern that would be repeated many times in their life together. More than anything else, this amused him. He had no doubts they would be married after his graduation. And how like Katie it was, thinking of saving the money and the benefit to himself. He had mentioned the need for a new stethoscope only once. Again, she pulled away her hand. The headlights of an approaching car bathed her in a brief glare, leaving him with the image of her sitting stiffly, fists clenched in her lap, eyes tightly closed.
"I love you, Katie," he said. "Oh, Stephen," she sighed. "Sometimes I ache with the love of you. It's just..."
"It's the waiting," he said.
"Shall we go to Mallow?" she asked.
He started the car and turned back the way they had come, thinking as he drove how lucky he was to have found Kate.
"Let's go around Cork," she said. "If someone should see us..." "Well, we shouldn't be seen coming from this direction."
"I know a shortcut to the Mallow Road," he said. She smiled in the darkness.
"Is that where you take all your girls?"
"Katie!"
"It's bad of me to tease," she said.
They drove in silence while Stephen turned off onto a narrow lane with high hedgerows on either side. This brought them presently to the Mallow Road at the 18-kilometer signpost.
"We'll be stopping at the Bridge House for petrol," Stephen said. "They've a restaurant."
"There'll be food at the fair," she said.
"You're not hungry?"
"Now that I think on it,
a sandwich would be fine."
And cheaper, he thought. Kate seldom stopped being practical. It was a trait he admired. She'd be a good manager. At the Bridge House he bought 2 beef sandwiches and 2 bottles of Guinness, passing them through the open window to Kate before paying for the petrol.
"The man says it's going thin, the left front tire," she said.
"I've had a look at your spare," the attendant said. "Would you be liking it changed?"
"No."
Stephen shook his head. "We've only a little ways to go."
"I'd be travelling it slow-like," the attendant said.
He accepted Stephen's money and made the change. "Slow as a peddler's cart and the horse ready for the knackers." Stephen hesitated, then,
"Slow tease."
He eased the car gently out of the Bridge House driveway behind a long lorry, which pulled away from him as he held his speed to 40 kilometers an hour. Now that there was a reason to go slowly and they were headed for Mallow, Kate found herself content. She rested her head against the back of the seat and looked at Stephen. It was good to be here with him. She could see a whole lifetime of interludes such as this. They would start saving for a car, she thought. It was none too soon, automobiles being so dear. She was about to say this to him when the left front tire blew. The car swerved onto the verge, bumped over a curbing stone, and slewed sideways on grass, coming to a stop with the headlights illuminating a grass-grown private driveway between 2 broken-down gateposts. The gate itself lay on its side against the right-hand post, leaving the driveway open. Stephen took several deep breaths through his open mouth, then,
"Katie, are you all right?"
His hands ached where they clutched the steering wheel.
"Shaken a bit," she said. "Should we be pulling off the road?"
Stephen swallowed and eased the car ahead into the grass-grown driveway. The way turned left almost immediately, and his headlights revealed the burned-out ruin of a cottage. All the charred roof beams collapsed into the center. He stopped the motor and they sat there a moment, listening to the insects and the faint murmuring of a nearby brook. Moonlight poured over the hills behind the ruined cottage. There was a forlorn feeling about the place.
"Well, I'd best be changing the tire," he said. "I'd like a sandwich first," she said.
He agreed and found an old blanket in the back, spreading it on the grass beside the car, then turning off the headlights. The moon was bright.
"Almost like day,"
Kate said as she brought the food to the blanket. They sat facing each other, chewing in unison, clinking their bottles of Guinness in a toast to the blown tire, the moon, to the folk who lived here when it was a happy house. Presently, Stephen finished his sandwich and drained his beer. Kate grinned at him. She didn't know whether it was the drink or just being here with Stephen, but she felt an enormous sense of contentment. This didn't stop her from saying, as he stood up,
"You'll get your jacket all dirty. Take it off, and the shirt with it, now."
She stood up and helped him,
folding the garments neatly and placing them on the edge of the blanket. He wore no undershirt, and the look of his bare chest in the moonlight she thought one of the most beautiful sights in the universe. Almost of its own volition, her right hand went out, and his chest was warm beneath her caressing palm. How it all happened, she could never fully explain afterward, even to her best friend and fellow student, Maggie McLinn.
"Oh, he was so strong, Maggie. I couldn't help myself. Nor did I want to. It's shameless of me, I know, but it...
Well, join the club, Katie, darling.
Will you be marrying now, I suppose?"
They sat alone together the following Monday on the quad, having an early lunch. Maggie had drawn the story out of her, having noticed Kate's quiet withdrawal. It had taken only a reminder of their childhood pledge never to lie to each other about important things. A tall, slender woman with hair the color of old gold, Maggie was considered one of the campus beauties. Some of the nursing students whispered that Maggie had chosen Kate as a friend to set off her own looks. But the truth was, they had been close friends from childhood, since their first day of primary school. Maggie repeated her question then.
"Didn't he even propose?" "I don't know what I'll say in confession, Maggie," Kate said. "God help me, what'll I do?"
"What you say is this. Father, forgive me. I've had a sexual experience. Tell him it was the drink and the great power of the man, and you'll never do it again."
"But what if we do?"
Kate wailed.
"I try to go to a different priest," Maggie said, matter of fact. "It saves the explaining."
She studied Kate a moment.
"I know you, Katie. Will you be marrying now?"
"Don't be stupid," Kate flared. Then,
"I'm sorry, Maggie. But he was at me about that all the way back. And you know we can't marry until he graduates, and maybe not until he has his own shingle out. We're not rich, you know."
"Then be careful, girl. You're the marrying kind, the both of you. And there's nothing like a little pregnancy to hurry things along."
"You think I don't know that?"